From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the Netherlands awaits the grim arrival of dozens of bodies recovered from the Malaysia Airlines plane in East Ukraine.
Responsibility for the investigators, of course, will be to identify those bodies, inform the next of kin, and work on the repatriation of those bodies to the loved ones around the world.
Also today, Britain's Prime Minister threatens prosecution for parents who allow their daughters to suffer genital mutilation. And the FAA suspend all flights in and out of Israel after Hamas rockets spark safety fears.
A rocket for the first time from Gaza hit a town, a suburb of Tel Aviv, which is really adjacent to the Ben-Gurion International Airport. That's Israel's main international airport.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest news headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is urging Israel and Hamas to start talking and negotiate an end to the conflict in Gaza. He was speaking in Israel after a meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. More than 600 Palestinians and 30 Israelis have been killed in the fighting over the past 2 weeks. And Mr. Ban, who is trying to breathe new life into Egyptian peace proposals, told reporters it must stop now.
My message to Israelis and Palestinians is the same. Stop fighting, start talking, and take on the root causes of the conflict so we are not back to the same situation in another 6 months or a year.
The U.S. government has ordered American airline carriers to suspend all flights to Tel Aviv after Israeli officials confirmed that a rocket fired from Gaza landed near Ben-Gurion Airport. FSN's Nina Maria Potts reports.
Delta and United had already grounded their jets. One Delta plane was diverted to Paris after the rocket landed near the airport. The cancellations reflect industry nervousness about flights operating in conflict zones in light of the shooting down of Malaysian airlines. Flight 17.
The Israeli authorities are furious about the FAA's decision. Reporter Josh Mitnick with The Wall Street Journal in Tel Aviv.
The statement attributed to Israel's transportation minister accusing these airlines of giving a, quote, prize to terror and saying that there's no reason why American air carriers should stop flights to Israel.
Forensic experts have begun the task of identifying the bodies of more than 200 passengers aboard Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. The remains are now in the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv, but are expected to be flown to the Netherlands over the next few hours. There, they will be transported to specialist facilities at a military barracks in the Dutch town of Hilversum. EU foreign ministers, meanwhile, have agreed to widen sanctions against Russia and move forward with measures that are expected to target the country's defence sector. Philip Hammond is Britain's foreign secretary.
We're looking at individuals who contribute to, in one way or another, the regime in the Kremlin and its interference in Ukraine and Crimea, or who have benefited from the decisions and actions of that regime.
President Obama visited the Dutch embassy in Washington on Tuesday and signed a book of condolence in memory of the passengers aboard the Malaysian Airlines flight. More than half the passengers were Dutch, and the president told the country's diplomats in Washington that he wants to ensure the families get justice.
We will work with them to make sure that loved ones are recovered, that a proper investigation is conducted, and that ultimately justice is done.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The British government is launching a public inquiry to see whether Russia bears responsibility for the radioactive poisoning of a former KGB agent. Alexander Litvinenko died in a London hospital in 2006. His family believes that he was murdered by the KGB in the British capital. His widow, Marina Litvinenko, says it's coincidental that the public inquiry is being launched at a time of renewed strain in the UK-Russia relationship.
We expected this news, but it's happened in a very serious moment of all this, I would say, breaking relationship. I already heard some comments on British channels from some people who tried to say Sasha did kill himself, he smuggled radioactive material. They even tried to provide this untruth here
And staying in London, Prime Minister David Cameron is calling for female genital mutilation and child marriage to be stopped worldwide within a generation. He spoke at the first Global Girl Summit, hosted by the British government and UNICEF in London. He announced new measures to combat FGM and forced marriage, including legislation aimed at prosecuting parents. Emily Cherry of Britain's National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children is attending the conference. She says education is key.
So getting this message out there to educate communities at risk, to educate communities that perpetrate, and to educate the wider public that this isn't an issue that's just solely in other countries. This is in the UK, and if we all work together, we can tackle this issue.
The main news again, the UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon is telling Israel and Hamas to stop fighting and start talking and end the conflict in Gaza. There's more from us on Twitter. You can interact with us there at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Forensic experts have begun the task of identifying the bodies of more than 200 passengers aboard Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. The remains are now in the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv, but are expected to be transported to the Netherlands imminently. In an earlier visit to the Dutch embassy in Washington, D.C., President Obama offered his deepest condolences on behalf of the United States. Our correspondent Dan Whitehead is reporting from the Dutch army barracks where the bodies will be taken, and began by explaining exactly what would happen to the remains on arrival.
Well, I'm currently stood on the outskirts of this medical military barracks facility on the outskirts of the town of Hilversum, some 20 miles south of Amsterdam. Already, soldiers here have been putting up red and white cordon tape, sealing off certain areas in preparation for the media frenzy, which will start here in the coming hours and will last for days, weeks and months ahead. What will happen here is, as the bodies land in Eindhoven, they will be brought to this facility. They will be taken through the gates in front of me here, being guarded by soldiers in uniform, and taken to the medical facilities at the rear of this facility. And they will be taking part in what is arguably the most important and first step in this major international investigation, and that, of course, is the formal identification process. This is a very complicated process. It is not just Dutch nationals who are being brought here, of course. There were many international victims on board MH17 from America, from the UK, and, of course, from Malaysia. The responsibility for the investigators, of course, will be to identify those bodies, inform the next of kin, and work on the repatriation of those bodies to the loved ones around the world. As I say, this is a major international investigation. It is being led by the Dutch government, also alongside the United Nations and the International Civil Aviation Organization.
And Dan, do we have any indication yet of how long this identification process will take?
Well, that is the question, and we had heard from the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, who said that the formal identification process for some of the victims could be quite swift, a couple of days until they inform the relatives, but in some cases it may take a number of weeks. He also said that for some of the victims it could take months to identify their bodies and their remains. We are also not sure that all of the casualties of MH17 were recovered from the crash site. That can't be verified, of course, and so all of the remains are brought here to this very controlled environment. But that length and that potential length of time that it can take to account for and identify those bodies means that this will be a very long-running and difficult situation for the families who have already been through so much grief. And that will only continue with this process taking so long. Once they have been identified, though, we do know that as quickly as possible they will be released to the families. Well, then they have can, of course, start preparing the final step for these victims, that, of course, of the funerals and services to remember their loved ones.
Dan Whitehead in Hilversum near Amsterdam. More deadly fighting has broken out in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region shortly after Ukrainian rebels allowed the transfer of both bodies and flight recorders recovered from the downed Malaysian jet. The remains of dozens of crash victims have yet to be recovered from the area. International observers at the scene of the disaster have expressed concern that the site has been tampered with ahead of an official investigation. Elena Kasas is in Donetsk, eastern Ukraine.
Well, a team of three Malaysian investigators who are aviation experts appointed by Malaysia Airlines finally arrived in Donetsk this morning, nearly 5 days after the crash. They were accompanied to the site by OSCE monitors and then spent about 3 or 4 hours, nearly four, going through the plane's wreckage. We saw them combing through the debris, photographing things, moving around the site. What they're looking for is either physical or chemical traces that could point towards what brought MH17 down out of the sky. We have heard reports already from US authorities that some other pieces of wreckage that were found in people's gardens several kilometres from the main crash site do have traces on them which point towards the type of missile that was used, and indeed they point towards the type that the US believes was used, a Russian-produced Buk missile. So these Malaysian investigators will be looking for proof of that theory. They also, of course, have the black boxes that were handed over to a Malaysian team by the separatists last night. Now, aviation experts say those black boxes might not actually reveal a great deal about what happened, because we probably aren't talking about a kind of plane malfunction. If it was hit by a missile, the most that the black boxes will reveal is that there was an explosion. So it's this combing through the wreckage that will probably be the key thing. Now, the experts only said a couple of things after today's investigation. One was that the wings of the plane had melted. So just imagine the strength of the temperatures there must have been for that to happen. Imagine the power of the explosion that caused that. And they also said, or rather OSCE monitors said on their behalf, that they believe the site has been tampered with. The OSCE said that since they first visited it 4 days ago, they have seen that parts of the fuselage have been moved. They also said that they saw some workers allied with the pro-Russian separatists going through parts of the wreckage with a power saw to try and work out what was going on there. So they quite directly accused the pro-Russian separatists of tampering with the wreckage.
What has been apparent from the moment this crash took place is that progress has been slow because the site sits in that rebel stronghold. But yesterday we did see that refrigerated train leave with the bodies, the victims of MH17, and that is now in another part of Ukraine awaiting transport to the Netherlands.
Progress on several fronts. Black boxes, the Malaysian investigators being able to investigate the site, and the bodies, which, as you said, left eastern Ukraine last night. They're now in Kharkiv, which is where we've been told investigators will take a look at them, try and identify them, and then they're all going to be put on a plane toward Amsterdam. And the Ukrainian authorities say that they will be sorted according to nationality when they get there. So we don't expect them to stay long in Kharkiv. We've heard that they'll be flying out tonight or tomorrow morning so that experts can look at them in Amsterdam.
Elena Kasas in Donetsk, eastern Ukraine, and our apologies for the poor quality of the line. The European Union says it will impose further sanctions against Russia over its alleged backing of separatists in Ukraine. However, the EU foreign ministers stopped short of so-called Stage 3 sanctions, which would deliver a more crippling blow to the Russian economy. Jack Parrock has been following the meeting, and I began by asking what exactly has come out of the EU Foreign Affairs Council.
The European Union foreign ministers meeting here in Brussels decided to remain in stage two of sanctions against Russia for their part in the unrest in Ukraine, especially following the downing of the plane MH17. There was talk that perhaps this might be the key to tipping the European Union to targeting broad areas of the Russian economy, things like energy deals and military deals. The French, for instance, are still in deals with Moscow for selling military hardware. We'll find out on Thursday the names and entities that are to be added to this list of stage two sanctions. But the question remains whether this is going to be enough to help engage Russia, to help engage in this crisis and stop arming the pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine, which is what the European Union is accusing Moscow of doing.
And Jack, why is there so much hesitance to impose stage three sanctions?
Well, there's a number of different reasons why stage three sanctions would be a problem. Firstly, the Dutch might be concerned that going right into the heart of the Russian economy and really kind of hitting the bee's nest with a stick could mean that there would be more problems in bringing home the bodies of the 193 Dutch victims that died on flight MH17. In addition to that, the big three players of the European Union's all have their own concerns surrounding stage three of sanctions. Britain, for instance, would be affected by a targeting of the Russian financial sector. There's a lot of deals in financial services between London and Moscow. As I mentioned before, the French have military contracts, which are important to their economy. And French President François Hollande said he hopes that no sanctions would affect that, and he doesn't think that the sanctions put out there at the moment are. Germany, on the other hand, if the EU slapped heavy restrictions on Russian gas imports, for instance, their energy sector would have an issue. Now, as far as security goes, clearly the countries further to the east, they have their security concerns, the ones that border Russia and Ukraine, for instance. And the European Union, clearly as a 28-member state bloc, everybody has different priorities. So it really does seem that it's going to take quite a lot to move into stage three of sanctions.
The Malaysian foreign minister is going to be in Brussels on Thursday. Is it likely he'll push the EU as well?
As part of a planned meeting between the EU foreign ministers and their ASEAN counterparts, the Malaysian foreign minister, Anifah Aman, is going to be here. He's expected to put pressure on the European Union to really look at what's going on. Clearly, the big players in this issue are the Dutch, with so many people having died on the plane from the Netherlands, Malaysia, because it was a Malaysian plane, and Russia and Ukraine, the site of all this unrest. So there's another big day in Brussels tomorrow with the foreign ministers here then.
Jack Parrock in Brussels. This is FSN Reports. America's Federal Aviation Administration has suspended flights to and from Tel Aviv for at least the next 24 hours in response to Hamas rocket fire. The development follows an earlier meeting over a possible ceasefire between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The US has already sent John Kerry to Egypt to support efforts as the Israeli operation in Gaza enters a third week. Over 600 people have been killed and thousands more wounded in the latest round of fighting between Hamas and Israel, according to Palestinian officials. And the death toll on the Israeli side is also climbing, with more than two dozen soldiers dead and one reportedly missing. Josh Mitnick is in Tel Aviv for the Wall Street Journal.
A rocket for the first time from Gaza touched down in the Tel Aviv metropolitan area, and it hit a town, a suburb of Tel Aviv, which is really adjacent to the Ben-Gurion International Airport. That's Israel's main international airport, and down about a mile from the landing strip. And in addition to that, American Airlines and Delta Airlines suspended their flights to Tel Aviv, and now I'm hearing that the Federal Aviation Authority is suspended flights for 24 hours, and we already have a response now from the Israeli Aviation Authority and the Israeli Transportation Ministry, and they are not happy with this decision. They are insisting that flights in and out of Tel Aviv are still safe. They're saying that they are trying to explain the situation to foreign air carriers, but what's also interesting is that they are clearly angry, at least with the decision of these airlines, and I assume now with the decision of the FAA, statement attributed to Israel's transportation minister accusing these airlines of giving a, quote, prize to terror and saying that there's no reason why American air carriers should stop flights to Israel.
And, of course, we had President Obama yesterday speaking at the White House, calling on both sides of the conflict to agree upon a ceasefire. He's dispatched John Kerry, who's still in Egypt, to try and put something together that could see a truce come about. But in the meantime, the death toll on both sides is rising, as is that civilian death toll in Gaza. Are we any clearer on the possibility, both sides of this war agreeing terms?
Well, obviously, diplomatic efforts have gone into a higher gear with the arrival of John Kerry in the region, with the statement of President Barack Obama that both sides have to stand down after 2 weeks of fighting. However, from the Israeli sources that I'm talking to, they don't see Hamas doing that, and they also don't see the Israeli government doing that, at least in the coming days. The assessment here is that both sides, both Hamas and Israel, are still looking for achievements on the battlefield. Israel's not satisfied that it has finished the job, exposing enough of the tunnel network inside the Gaza Strip that it has come to see as a strategic threat on its the border region around the Gaza Strip. And what I'm hearing is that even after that, if Israel's conditions are for a ceasefire, number one, that the ceasefire doesn't end up giving Hamas a political boost, and that Israel's security concerns are taken into account. If those conditions aren't taken into effect, it doesn't matter who calls for a ceasefire, that Israel will continue to fight.
Josh Mitnick in Tel Aviv for The Wall Street Journal. Now, the British government has announced it's to hold a public inquiry into the 2006 death of Russian dissident Alexander Litvinenko, who allegedly died from radioactive polonium poisoning. The family of the former KGB officer who lived in exile in London claim he had been working for British intelligence services when he died. The British government has long resisted a pressure from Mr. Litvinenko's widow to hold a public inquiry, and questions are now being asked about the timing of this announcement. From London, Catherine Drew reports.
43-year-old Alexander Litvinenko had tea at a London hotel with two Russian men on November 1, 2006. Later that night, he fell ill and a few days later was admitted to hospital. Medical teams worked in vain but could not save him. He had been poisoned with the highly radioactive material polonium-210. The apparent assassination caused an outcry in Britain. A British murder investigation pointed to Andrei Lugovoy, a member of Russia's Federal Protective Service, as the prime suspect. Russia refused an extradition request, leading to the cooling of relations. Litvinenko, his wife and son, fled to London in 2000 and were granted asylum. He had worked for Russia's FSB secret service, specializing in tackling organized crime. In 1998, he and other officers publicly accused their superiors of ordering the assassination of the Russian tycoon and oligarch Boris Berezovsky, who himself fled to Britain in 2003 and was found hanged in 2013. Litvinenko was twice arrested on charges of exceeding the authority of his position and twice acquitted before he fled Russia with his family. In London, he wrote books accusing Russia's secret services of staging terrorism. He also accused President Vladimir Putin of ordering the 2006 murder of Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. When he himself was killed, Litvinenko's friends, among the community of Russian exiles, were in no doubt who was responsible. In 2007, Alex Goldfarb spoke to journalists at London's Frontline Club.
What makes us think that it was Mr. Putin, personally? Without a government connection, you cannot get hold of polonium. And this connection should be much higher than the FSB itself, because it requires interdepartmental interaction. So it should be a very, very high level that approved, not to mention political, but simply structurally, the use of polonium for this particular operation.
Litvinenko's widow, Marina, has long campaigned for a public inquiry into her husband's death, something which has been resisted by the British government because of what they call sensitive material that would come to light. But earlier this year, Marina Litvinenko took her fight to Britain's High Court, which ruled in February that the government had been wrong to rule out a public inquiry. Following the government's change of heart, Marina issued a written statement.
I am relieved and delighted with this decision. It sends a message to Sasha's murderers. No matter how strong and powerful you are, truth will win out in the end, and you will be held accountable for your crimes. I look forward to the day when the truth behind my husband's murder is revealed for the whole world to see.
Now, a senior judge, Sir Robert Owen, who was acting coroner in the inquest that was never completed, has been appointed. The inquiry will look into whether the Russian state was behind Litvinenko's death. Government officials have refused to comment on the timing of this announcement, coming as Russia is at the centre of international outrage over the downing of flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine. Dr. Alan Mendoza from the UK's Henry Jackson Society says the timing of the announcement is notable.
Some of us have known for a long time that it wasn't investigated in the fullest way possible, should we just say, and that there were political reasons for doing that because of the immense pressure put by the Kremlin on those to cease investigating it. Now, because there is now this backlash against Putin and what he has done in Ukraine, we are less susceptible to pressure. And I think we are much more willing to investigate past potential misdeeds to see what might come of a full inquiry into them.
8 years after his death, an inquiry into who ordered the killing of the Russian dissident, Alexander Litvinenko, is finally underway. Catherine Drew, London.
Parents in Britain who fail to prevent their daughters from suffering female genital mutilation, FGM, will face prosecution. The warning from UK Prime Minister David Cameron on Tuesday as a new study revealed that nearly 140,000 women in England and Wales have been subjected to FGM. LBC Radio tackled the issue with Emily Cherry of the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children.
Be aware of the signs of female genital mutilation. Be aware that those communities that are at risk. We have a fantastic resource in our website, so I would urge people to go in and have a look at the information that we give out on the NSPCC's website.
It must be very encouraging for yourselves as well that we're holding a summit, global summit here in Southwark. What have you learned this morning?
So certainly we've been hearing a lot from survivors and hearing about the effect that this practice is having on women and girls around the world. You know, we would be calling absolutely for more therapeutic support services for victims of FGM. We've heard about the practices of it. We've heard what politicians are seeking to do and the criminal aspect.
It's encouraging that, as you said, that the governments are there. Some top ministers there holding talks and doing Q&As today. That must be encouraging because you're going in the same direction. You set up this helpline, but everyone's pushing in the right direction.
Absolutely, and the helpline is backed by a Home Office campaign, which we launched a few weeks ago. This campaign is going into bathrooms in the UK that we know what the communities most at risk are using, and really targeting community leaders and particularly mothers themselves to see this as child abuse, to recognise the signs and then seek support through the NSPCC helpline.
Now, just quickly, we've got all these different measures now. The ministers are involved, you've got your helpline sorted. Is it a problem that can be solved, or is it something that's going to be pushed underground now?
I mean, it's so shocking that so many thousands of children in the UK are at risk of this practice, but we're not surprised by it from the calls that we've been getting through to the helpline. The number one thing that needs to continue to happen, apart from helpline services and therapeutic services, is education. So getting this message out there to educate communities at risk, to educate communities that perpetrate, and to educate the wider public that this isn't an issue that's just solely in other countries. This is in the UK, and if we all work together, we can tackle this issue.
Emily Cherry of the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children talking to Britain's LBC Radio. And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Simon Marks on the bulletin desk. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.